Okay, so the next sutta that I have here is called the soil remover, and this particular sutta is one of the suttas I like a lot, so I always tend to use this particular sutta. And the idea behind this sutta is that it shows you how there is a gradual removal, a gradual path, a gradual movement towards the states of samadhi, the states of meditation, and how that gradual process can be understood. And this is one of the main themes that we find in the suttas. Across the teachings of the Buddha, this theme of this gradual movement, how you move stage by stage from where you start off all the way to the end of the Buddhist path. And this is one way of looking at it. There's another way. There's something actually called, known in the suttas as the gradual training, which is a very long discourse, and it has a lot of detail about how to do the practice. And that would have been great to do this here, but it's a bit too long for this particular retreat, so I've chosen a kind of a shorter version instead. This is the short version of that, but it gives you a rough idea what this gradual training is all about. This is called known as the soil remover, and the soil remover, this is like the simile or the metaphor that is being used to explain what the gradual training of the gradual removal of defilements is all about. One of the interesting things about the Buddhist path, one of the ways of understanding almost the whole path of Buddhism is to understand it in terms of the removal of the defilements or the corruptions of the mind. That's basically what it's all about. And you may have heard of a very famous work by a famous scholar called Buddhaghosa, who wrote this work 1,500 years ago. It's called the Visuddhimagga, which means the path of purification. And the idea is that purifying yourself is basically what this whole path is about. It's a gradual removal of these defilements. And the whole path can be understood in terms of this purification process. So this is actually almost like the essence of the Buddhist path, purifying yourself. And first of all, you purify yourself stage by stage. And it's like a temporary purification until you get to the point where your meditation becomes very profound and very deep. And then once you achieve, once you gain access to those very deep states of meditation practice, then you can actually remove those defilements permanently. So it's like a two-stage process. There's a gradual abandoning right here and right now. And this is kind of the hard slug, right? We have to work hard to get rid of all these defilements, and then once you get to the point where they're all gone, then you can actually have gained the real insight, and that removes these defilements permanently once and for all. So this is why it's called the path of purification, right? There's a gradual movement away from these things. So this is this then is one way of looking at the Buddhist path, and this particular sutta is about that particular process. So let's see what the Buddha has to say, and I'll comment as I go along, as I did last time. Bhikkhus, in other words, monks, they are gross defilements of gold, soil, grit, and gravel. Grit is just dust or whatever, you know, bad stuff basically. Now the soil remover or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it. A trough is like a big basin. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain middle-sized defilements in the gold, fine grit and coarse sand. The soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain subtle defilements in the gold, fine sand and black dust. So the soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, only grains of gold remain. So this is the simile for the purification of the mind. The purification of gold here is used as a simile. And one of the beautiful things about this particular simile is the idea of comparing the mind to gold, right? The mind is like gold. The mind is something very valuable and very beautiful. And this is part of what the simile is about. So first of all, gold, it's considered beautiful by people. That's why you wear gold, you know, gold jewelry, all these kind of things. It's something which shines and which has a kind of radiance to it, and considered valuable. It's the same thing everywhere you go in the world. Gold is considered valuable everywhere. And the mind is basically similar. The mind is something that when you purify the mind, the mind starts to shine a bit like gold, become very beautiful. And the feeling is something which radiates, right? Something which radiates outwards, something which has all these, you know, beautiful qualities of love and compassion and kindness. And you feel it radiating out into the world in a similar way in which gold radiates light and radiates beauty. It's almost like you can feel that for yourself, that the mind becomes beautiful when it becomes free of defilements. It's something very, very positive. It's like a very positive experience, a very, very wholesome experience in a sense. And this, you can actually see that. So the mind becomes radiant. This is one of the metaphors used for the mind throughout the suttas. The mind is radiant. It's like a sun shining and blazing away, the same way as gold does. So this is the first thing. The second thing is the idea of gold being valuable, right? What is valuable in the world? What do we mean when something is valuable? Why is something valuable to somebody? And something has value because it makes you feel happy to some extent, right? You got some, you have some gold, you know, stored up in the vault like big bars, and you think that that's going to make you happy. Or just you have some nice jewelry, some nice golden jewelry here. And there is a degree to which that makes you happy. If it didn't make you happy, you wouldn't be using it or wearing it. So gold has a sense of something valuable. It's valuable because it gives you a certain sense of happiness or whatever it is. And of course, the mind is valuable in a far, far greater way than gold. It's pretty trivial. Okay, you have some golden jewelry. It's pretty trivial how much happiness it gives you. But of course, the mind, which is purified, it is an immense source of happiness. And this is the main reason why we are pursuing the refined and purified mind, because it is this incredible source of happiness. When the mind is pure, you just feel inside of yourself this this energy, you have lots of energy, you have lots of brightness, you can think incredibly clearly, you feel a natural sense of compassion and joy in the world. All these qualities that we're searching for are a consequence of the purification of the mind, right? So it's a very, very, it brings enormous amounts of happiness. And this is one of the things that you see in the suttas of the Buddha. He always talks about the purified mind is a happy mind. Purified mind is a source of happiness, whereas the defiled mind is a source of enormous, enormous suffering, according to the suttas. Whenever there are defilements there, they are basically a source of suffering. This is the other thing. So please remember that the idea of gold here is that when you have the pure mind, it's like you have gold. You have achieved something which is very valuable, very incredibly, basically the sort of thing that everybody wants in the world. That's what you achieve by purifying the mind. So this is that is the first aspect of this simile. The second aspect is here the idea of purification, right? Gold is only nice once it gets purified. When you dig the gold out of the ground and it comes together with all the dirt and all the stones and all the stuff, there's not much to it. It's dull, it doesn't shine, it doesn't really have anything. And it's exactly the same idea with the mind. The mind is only beautiful once it gets purified. An ordinary mind, an ordinary life, when you get a bit irritated or you have desires, you get confused and all these kind of things, it's okay. It's still, obviously, it's good, you know, it still does its job, so to speak, and whatever that is. But it's nothing kind of very special about it. And just as gold, you have to refine it first. You have to refine the mind. And when the defilements get taken away, that's when the beauty of the mind starts to shine forth. There's a beautiful sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya once, that says that the mind is kind of naturally radiant. It's just that it is defiled by like the visiting defilements. When you remove the visiting defilements, that's when the natural beauty of the mind comes out and comes to the fore. And this process of purification that we're talking about here is a gradual process. And that's why it starts off with the coarse defilements of the mind. It moves on to the middling defilements, then it moves on to the refined defilements of gold. And if you want to purify gold, you have to do it in that order, right? You can't really, you have to start off taking out the coarse things first, Then you take the middle things, then you take the refined things. There's a certain process that you have to go through. Huh? And it is exactly the same thing for the mind. You have to do it in the right process. You can't start, you know, sitting down, taking away the most refined defilements if you have some very coarse things going on. So you have to do it in the right way. And only when you do it in the right way does it actually work. Is it actually possible to refine the mind? So you have to do it in the right sequence. And this, to be able to do that in the right sequence, what you have to do is you have to have knowledge of yourself. You have to understand yourself. This is a very important part of the Buddhist path. And this is one of the things that you learn when you come on a meditation retreat like this. Yes, you learn to be more peaceful, you learn to have developed a bit of loving kindness and metta and all these things. But one of the things you do learn is you learn about yourself. And sometimes that can be painful, right? You see, I didn't know I had these defilements and I had all these things going on. Sometimes when there's no escape from yourself and you have to see your mind, sometimes you see things you don't really want to see. You see things that in ordinary life you just push aside and you just go and have a cup of coffee instead because you don't want to see what's going on. But here you get to know yourself. And this is like this idea of being almost, you know, this English expression of being brutally honest with yourself. You have to be almost like brutally honest and to see what's happening. And when you have that brutal honesty with yourself and you know what your problems are, then you can start where the biggest problems are and then gradually refine yourself down. So you get a chance to see this here. You get the chance to get to know yourself. Understand your mind. Understand where the real problems are. And then you start from those biggest ones. And then over time, as they start to decrease because you practice in the right way, you can start with the middling defilements. And then eventually you come to the refined defilements. And eventually you end up with pure gold, right? Just like the simile of the gold here. So self-knowledge is very important. And that self-knowledge is what enables us to do this process in the right way. If you start off with the most refined things, you're never going to get anywhere. Okay, so let us move on a little bit. Also, maybe I should just comment as well, maybe very briefly, on this idea of the soil remover and his apprentice. What is this business about the remover and his apprentice? What's that all about? It's possible that it's just an idiom, a way that it was, you know, things were done at that time in India. There was the kind of the master, the kind of oil soil remover, and then he had a young one next to him who was learning the soil removing business, so to speak. That is one possibility, but I think another way of looking at this is also just to see this as the soil remover is like the Buddha. He has done it already. He knows what soil removing means because he has already performed that process. And the apprentice then, that's us, right? We're trying to learn this thing from the Buddha himself. Okay, so what happens next? Once you have eliminated those refined defilements of the gold, this is what happens next. The goldsmith or his apprentice now pours the gold into a melting pot and fans it, melts it, and smelts it. But even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled. The dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, wieldy, and luminous, but still brittle and not properly fit for work. But as the goldsmith or his apprentice continues to fan, melt, and smelt the gold, a time comes when the gold is settled, and the dross has been entirely removed, so that the gold becomes malleable, wieldy, and luminous, pliant and properly fit for work. Then, whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, earrings, a necklace, or a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. So the idea here is that even when the kind of superficial defilements have been removed, there still are very, very fine things left in the gold, which also have to be removed for the gold to be ready to actually be used in the proper way. And the gold, which is ready to be removed in the to be used in the proper way, it has all these qualities. It is malleable, right? Malleable means it's like it's soft. It can be used. It can be shaped according to however you want to shape it. Wieldy is a similar kind of idea. It's luminous, right? Only when the defilements are removed does it become luminous, bright and beautiful. It's pliant, again, similar kind of thing, properly fit for work. So just as gold only becomes pliant, only has these qualities when all the defilements are removed, it's exactly the same thing for the mind. The mind, not only does the mind which is free of defilement become very beautiful and a, you know, joy to be with that sort of mind, you just feel happy, you feel so good with that kind of mind. Not only that, but the mind also becomes incredibly powerful. Is what we mean by fit for work. A mind with no defilements in it is a mind that you can almost, you can use it for any kind of purpose that you like, right? And of course the purpose that we try, that we really want to use it for in Buddhist teaching is for insight. And at this point, when the defilements are 100% removed, that is when insight really becomes possible. Why? Well, because it is fit for work. It is pliant, it is wieldy. You can move the mind wherever you look. You will be able to see whatever you want to see, because the mind is ready. The mind is no longer now, if you are, you know, when the defilements are there, you can try to look at things, you can try to move the mind, you can try to watch the breath, but it doesn't want to watch the breath, right? You sit down, you close your eyes, and nothing happens, and you think about things, and you have to take it back to the breath, and it moves away, and it doesn't really work. Why is that? It's because the mind is not fit for work, it's not malleable, it's not wieldy. When the defilements are removed, and you watch the breath, it's easy, it's incredibly easy. You can't, you know, it's impossible not to be able to do it. And that's the whole point here. So whenever you apply the mind to at that point, the mind will stick to it. Your ability to focus, your ability to be mindful, your ability to have samadhi, all of these things, it is so natural and so easy when the defilements are taken away. That is why it is that this is said. And of course, in the sutta, it's not just the ability to have insight and samadhi, which is built up. Anything you want to do at this point can be done according to the suttas. And one of those interesting things that can be done at that point, when the defilements are gone, is you can recall your past lives, right? This is what it says in the suttas. If you want to, when the mind is in that state, because it is so powerful, you can start thinking, you can start looking into the past and go backwards, stage by stage. And then you go back to the time maybe when you were a baby, right? You can actually remember when you were a baby, when your mind is that powerful. You go back and back and back. And eventually you make the jump. And then you go back, you see yourself as an old woman or old man in the past life, about to die. And then you can continue going backwards like that. Interesting, isn't it? But this is the potential, and this is one of the purposes why you want to develop this kind of mind, because it is very powerful and it can give you rise to these insights which otherwise you can't really have. So this is what this is about. So that is the simile. So now let us look at the actual how this works out with the mind itself. So too, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind, there are in him gross defilements, bodily, verbal and mental misconduct or bad conduct. An earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, terminates and obliterates them. When this has been done, there remain in him middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them too. When this has been done, there remain in him subtle defilements, thoughts about his relations, thoughts about his country, and thoughts about his reputation. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them too. When this has been done, then there remain thoughts connected with the Dhamma. That samadhi, that stillness, is not yet peaceful and sublime, not gained by full tranquilization, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forceful suppression, he has here, of the defilements. So here again, the idea here, as I was just saying before, is the idea of the gradual removal of defilements, stage by stage. And it says here, the bhikkhu who is devoted to the higher mind, please remember that when you read the suttas, they are mostly given to the monks, because the Buddha obviously was a monk himself, And most of the teachings are given to the monks. It doesn't mean that they're only applicable to the monks. They're just as applicable to the nuns. And they're also applicable to the lay people as well. Perhaps to a slightly lesser extent, because as a monk or a nun, you have these are the kind of things that you're always trying to practice towards, where layperson is a bit more intermittent, perhaps. But still, the basic structure and the basic ideas are just as applicable to anyone on the path. So please keep that in mind. And so when one is devoted to the higher mind is the mind I was talking about before, the mind of samadhi, the mind of the jhanas, the mind which you obtain by removing the defilements, right? This is what the higher mind means. It's usually defined, adi-citta is the word here, it's defined as the four jhanas elsewhere in the suttas. So this is what you need to do if you are devoted to the higher mind. In other words, you're trying to achieve this higher mind. So you start off, and when you start off on the path, there might be gross defilements in you, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. And the earnest, capable person abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates these. So these are the most coarse kind of defilements, right? These are the things such as the precepts we were talking about before, making sure that you don't kill living beings, that you don't steal, there's no sexual misconduct, but also the verbal side of things, that you don't lie and this kind of stuff. So this is what basically is meant here. So anyone, again, who is serious about the Buddhist path, it's very good to learn about the basic virtues of the Buddhist path, the virtues of bodily conduct and also verbal conduct. And then there is the mental conduct, is also part of this. And the mental conduct in this particular case is the kind of thoughts that tend to lead towards your breaking the precepts or acting in the wrong way or saying the wrong kind of things. So these are the coarse kind of mental conduct, you know, the kind of envy, you know, I wish I had what this person has, you know, may their property become mine or something like that. That is kind of the bad things you have. So these are the coarse things. So this is basically about the virtue, the ordinary external virtue that we see in most people. So then it says here that the earnest, capable monk, he abandons these things. And of course, the first point here is that you have to be earnest and capable. That's interesting, isn't it? It's not going to happen unless you really apply yourself. You really have to want this. You really have to understand the value in these things. And this is part of why this symbol here is so powerful. Because it tells you that there's something very valuable to be achieved. And by understanding that there's something very valuable here, for me, to be perfectly honest with you, for me, these teachings of Buddhism, these are basically, for me, the answer to the meaning of life, basically. As far as I'm concerned, this is what it's all about. What else do you want to do with your life? And purify yourself, become more happy, to help other people as well, perhaps, to become more happy, to abandon the suffering and the problems in life. What else matters? To me, this is the very purpose of life. And this, once you understand that this is the meaning of life, and you get a feeling for that, you understand that there's something very powerful to be achieved and to be attained on this path, then of course, then the earnestness and the perseverance and the ability to do these things, it arises as a consequence of that. So this is one of the reasons why it is so useful to read these suttas, to start to understand that there is something. You start to understand what the goal of these teachings are, what the point of these things are. And then you start to move in that direction yourself. I find it very... I don't know, it took me a long time to understand this, but once I started to really get into the Buddhist teachings, understand what they were about, it really opened my eyes about the very purpose of life. You know, the Buddha always begins one of his main teachings of the idea of the Four Noble Truths, right? You have the Four Noble Truths. And the first Noble Truth is about suffering. So, of course, the flip side of suffering is happiness. Once you teach someone about suffering, you also teach them about happiness. If you can eliminate suffering, you will obviously be happy. So suffering and happiness go together. And when you look inside of yourself and you ask yourself, what is it that you want in life? Look at the desires you have. We are basically run by desires, right? Everything we do all throughout the day is desires that drive almost everything we do. you know, our life is absolutely full of desires and cravings and attachments and all these kind of things. Every time you choose something, every time you make a choice based on a certain desire. When you choose what you're going to have for breakfast, when you choose when you're going to sit on a cushion or a bench, when you choose almost anything, what you're going to wear in the morning, what kind of job you have, what kind of religion or no religion you're going to follow. Why are you here on this retreat? Why do you come here? Do you come here because you think you're going to learn something useful, or do you think you're going to come here because you want to suffer some more? And the answer is obvious, right? You come here because you want to be happy here. That's why you do these things. That's why I'm here too. I don't come here because I think it's a lot of suffering to teach a little bit. I think it's going to be good for me. I think I will learn something, and it's nice to be of service, right? I do this because I want to be of service to somebody else. So it's a kind of mutual thing here. So everything we do in life is based on this idea, this movement. We want to move towards more well-being, towards more happiness, towards more joy, towards more peace, towards more meaning in life. We want to fulfill ourselves in a certain way. And then the Buddha comes along and says, well, actually, I have discovered how this is to be done. I understand this, right? I understand how you can finally fulfill all those aspirations, all that craving inside that you have, all this thing which wants happiness. I now understand how you can do this. Right? So the very thing that we always want inside of us, the very driving force, the thing that we always want to fulfill in this kind of itch, which is the craving that we have to fulfill, the Buddha says, I understand how this can be fulfilled. So for me, this is, if you want to understand the meaning of life, you have to understand human psychology. Human psychology is about getting this fulfillment of our desires and cravings. And of course the Buddha says, you're not going to find the solution by fulfilling the craving. If you just follow the objects of your desires, that happiness is never going to come. What you have to do instead, you have to find that fulfillment in a different way. And this is the path to that fulfillment. You start off by being kind, and you find the joy and happiness by being kind, you find the joy and happiness through meditation practice, and then you find that your craving starts to become eliminated, your craving starts to disappear, and then one day the craving is completely gone, and all you feel is a sense of fulfillment. You feel full inside of yourself. Craving is a feeling of lack, right? There's something you haven't got which isn't there. You don't feel complete, you don't feel fulfilled. That's what craving is all about. When the craving is gone, you feel fulfilled. You feel complete as a person for the first time in your life. And that is such a marvelous thing to feel, when you feel full and complete. There's nothing in the whole world that you want or need. You feel, finally, I've reached the goal of what this craving was all about. And so this is why these teachings are the answer to the meaning of life, because they fulfill the very deep psychological yearning, deep psychological desire that we all have of fulfillment, of feeling complete in life. So anyway, I'm getting a bit sidetracked here, but this is basically why, to me, these teachings are so powerful. And once you start to understand this, then that's when you become earnest, right? That's when you become capable. That's when you start to persevere. Because you keep these kind of things in the back of your mind all the time. Then why on earth would you not want to practice this path? Why on earth would you want to do something else? You know, sometimes it's tempting, right? Even as a monk, and I think, oh, I could go back into life, I could have a bit of fun, I could have a girlfriend, all this kind of stuff, you know. Then I think, there could be lots of nice things with that. But then I think there is something bigger here. I only have maybe 20, 30 years left of my life. Then I'll be dead. And what if I look back on my life, what would I have wished that I had done with that time? And I'm so worried about wasting my time, basically. But I just want to keep on doing what makes sense to me. And this is why I'm one of the main reasons I'm still a monk after 20 years. And I hope I still continue for a long time to go. So that is the removal of the coarse defilements, and the capable person does that. So you really have to persevere, you have to investigate, right? You have to know yourself, you have to know what you can do. You always have to think, how can I purify myself more? And you have to kind of go against the grain, go against your habits. One of the reasons why these things are so hard is because we have habits, and the habits are so strong, and you want to go against the habits, it's very hard. I know it's very common for us too often to complain about other people. You know, we have a wife or a husband or kids, children or whatever it is, and we want to change our, you know, the people who are closest to us. But remember how hard it is to change yourself. Remember that. And when you know how hard it is to change yourself, I always think, how can I ask other people to change when I know how hard it is to change myself? I can't really ask that. I shouldn't really complain about them. They are just a product of their own conditioning. They are a product of their own past. I just have to accept them for what they are. And then maybe change can happen on that basis. Okay, so then you are capable. And then what you do when you are earnest and capable and committed to the path, then you abandon, dispel, terminate, and obliterate these things. And this is the place where you have to be very careful. And the next sutta I'm going to read out will show you why you have to be careful. Because it sounds, the way this is translated, it sounds like you use a lot of willpower, right? You obliterate is not a kind of gentle, very gentle word. It's kind of like, it feels like you have to kind of control things, using your mind, using your willpower. But the point here, and this is, I think, is an extremely important point, is that the best way to obliterate anything, the best way to abandon anything, is not by using willpower. Willpower, all you really do is you suppress it for a while, and once the willpower, it's like you're kind of holding something down by force. Once the willpower is taken away, it pops up again straight away. That's the problem with willpower. Willpower isn't all that useful. So if we can't use willpower, then what does this mean? If willpower is no good, how do we terminate things? How do we obliterate them? And the answer is that the way you do it is through wisdom, through understanding. Understanding is the way to actually remove these things. And the reason why understanding is so powerful is because the real Buddhist understanding is understanding that something is not worthwhile pursuing. It's understanding that something is painful, right? When you understand that something is, this is what insight into dukkha is all about. You understand that something is painful. When you understand something is painful, you don't have to think, should I drop this or not? Should I get rid of it? It's obvious you try to get rid of it. And the very similarly I always use is the idea of when you kind of, you have a hot plate in your house, right? A hot plate where you do all the cooking and things. And sometimes you put your hand by accident onto the hot plate because you think it has been turned off, when in fact it has been on just before. And when you put your hand on the hot plate, it pulls back straight away. You don't have to think, should I take it away or not? You know, it's not like that, right? It's an automatic reaction. You just pull it back. And it's exactly the same thing. When you have wisdom, when you understand that things are painful, they're suffering, you pull back. The mind pulls back all by itself. And this is the kind of wisdom that we try to develop on the Buddhist path. We try to understand why doing bad things is bad. You try to understand why it leads to your own harm and suffering. You try to understand why it leads to the harm and suffering of others. And when you understand that, it's almost like you don't have to think more of that. It pulls back automatically and you start to become a nice, nice person. Of course, the reality is that this is the ideal situation, just using wisdom. The reality is that it's not going to work out usually. You can't just use wisdom. It's just too difficult for many people. So a bit of willpower is also required. Sometimes you have to say, no, I don't want to go there, and use a bit of willpower, simply because the wisdom isn't developed enough yet. So there is a little bit of willpower there. But the main idea, wisdom is the most powerful thing here. And wisdom is the only thing that can obliterate these things and terminate these things. You can't terminate them with willpower. You can only terminate these things with wisdom power. Once the mind turns away, it's completely gone, at least for a while. Okay, so let's move on because time, as always, is short. Life is short and time is shorter. So let's have a look at the second factor here. When this has been done, they remain in him or her middling defilement, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable person abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. So these are the middling things. The first part of the defilements are about external things, about body and speech in particular, and also those defilements that give rise to bad bodily conduct and speech conduct. And here we are moving more into the area of the mind, right? Sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming. Sensual thoughts is any thought that is connected with the sensual pleasures of the world, the five senses, any kind of desire you have in regard to the five senses. Thoughts of ill will, basically any kind of thought, any kind of thinking, you know, where you are angry or you are upset about something, or even if you have an irritation about something, is part of that. The last one here is the thoughts, thoughts of harming. And thoughts of harming, these are the kind of thoughts when your mind is called to the suffering of other people. And I think one way of translating this is translating as ruthlessness. You're ruthless, right? A ruthless person is somebody who doesn't really care about the feelings of other people. You do it regardless of what other people think. It's like the business person who's only interested in money and doesn't care about whether it creates suffering or problems around them in the world. That's what ruthlessness means. Ruth, you know the name? Do you have the name Ruth in Finnish? Ruth? People call Ruth in Finnish? You do? Yeah? Okay. And the word Ruth actually means compassion. That's what it means. That's the kind of the root meaning of that word. So ruthless means literally without compassion. So ruthlessness is this state of being without compassion. And listen what this is. It's the cold-hearted person, the non-compassionate person. And it's interesting that this is part of wrong thinking, right? It's not just the active wrong thinking of desires and ill will. It's actually the lack of compassion is also a bad kind of thought. We don't really care about others. It's the cold-heartedness is also a problem here. So you're supposed to have like caring for other beings. You're supposed to feel bad, if you know, you're supposed to feel something is wrong if you cause other people to suffer, etc. This is part of right thinking here. And again, to abandon these kind of thoughts, this gets more difficult, right? It's quite easy to understand why bad speech and bad action causes problems for ourselves and others. It's more difficult to understand why the thinking mind is like this. And this becomes harder at this point to actually do this kind of elimination of defilement. This kind of purification is more difficult. And I will get into this more when I come to the next sutta. I will go skip over it fairly quickly right now because otherwise we'll be here a long time. And then we come to the third stage of these defilements. When this has been done, there remain in him subtle or her subtle defilements, thoughts about his or her relations, thoughts about the country, thoughts about the reputation. An earnest and capable person abandons, dispels, terminates and obliterates even them. So now your mind is starting to become very pure, right? But there are still some problems there. And these problems that you're seeing here, these are problems that have a lot to do with your identity as a person, right? What is your identity? Your identity is often about the family background you come from, right? Who your family is, your parents, your sisters, etc. We define ourselves according to our family. And that's why some of our strongest attachments are to our family members, right? Whether it's our blood family or our where we are married into. Thoughts about your country. We often tend to think ourselves as coming from a certain country, from a certain background. So whatever it is. This also is kind of has to do with identity, who you are, you know, who you think of yourself as. And of course, reputation. Reputation is about what other people think about you, what kind of social position you have, what kind of education you have, all these kind of things. Now the problem with all of these things is that there's a couple of problems with these. And the first one is that it tends to limit us, right? If I am a Norwegian, I have this background, this kind of education, and that's all I am. So this is kind of, you narrow down into this narrow little thing, and then that's, and you kind of limit yourself because of that. And then when you go out into the world, you kind of separate, it also separates you from other people. If I have this identity, then somebody with a different identity is like, they are a bit far away. And you kind of feel slightly alien from people with a different kind of background. And this is a problem. It separates us from others. It makes it much harder to be compassionate and understanding. And that's why it is much easier to go to war in a country far away with a weird culture, with people who speak a different language or whatever, because you have nothing in common with these people. It's easy to send bombers to Afghanistan because you think that Afghanis, well, they are people, but only just people, right? Not really. But this is a bit, I think this is quite a natural thing, that we feel that the people who are closest to us, they are the ones we can understand as real people. The further away they are, the more difficult it is to understand them as people in quite the same way. But by eliminating these defilements, you start to open up, you start to see the humanity everywhere, right? You understand that the Afghanis and the Iraqis basically are just like us. They don't want to go to war, they want to have a peaceful life, they want to have a good life. Okay, maybe they are blinded by their religion to some extent, no doubt that is true. But still, deep down somewhere, they want happiness. Even that blindness to their religion is basically because they want to be happy. They think they're going to go to heaven or whatever if they do bad things. So they have the same kind of feel, it's similar to us. So by taking away these boundaries, it opens up the possibility of having more compassion in the world. You stop dividing people into genders, into nationalities, into colors, into education groups, into social groups, and you see people just as people wherever they are. There was a famous monk in Thailand who once said that, you know, it doesn't really matter. I think somebody asked him, you know, why don't you go traveling more? You know, don't you want to see the world or something? Is that interesting to go around and see in the world? And he said, you know, it's the same wherever you go. That's what he said. People are the same. People have the same desires. People have the same, you know, hopes for life. But the food is a bit different, but so what? It doesn't really make much difference. So the differences are so superficial, but deep down, basically, we have the same wants and we have the same aspirations in life. So for these reasons, it is, you know, this is one reason why it is useful to get rid of these barriers. And even animals are very similar to us, right? Animals too want to be happy. Those of you who have pets, you know that the dog wants to be happy. He wants the nice food. He wants to be treated well, right? We all are in the same boat, so to speak, in many ways. Now, the second thing about this, which is problematic about these things, is that it is an obstacle in your meditation practice. If you have a very strong sense of identity, that identity needs to be defended all the time. You need to think certain thoughts, you have to think in a certain way to be able to defend that personality you are. Sometimes when you become very peaceful, the mind actually wants to think to defend your sense of identity. And you can see that as you become peaceful. You feel almost like you become identityless. And that can be a little bit frightening for some people. So by reducing these defilements, you are reducing the need to defend yourself in meditation, to kind of feel like you are a certain person, that you are a certain, you know, whatever it is, and you can let go of this identity much more easily. And the deeper the meditation goes, the less identity you have, right? The less difference there is between you and other people, because they are experiencing also that depth of meditation, and that experience is extremely similar for all of us. The sense of joy and peace, where identity starts to disappear, where the normal differences between us, like gender differences or whatever it is, that starts to disappear in meditation practice. And the deeper you go, you come to the stage where there is no gender anymore. That is gone. There is obviously nothing else. All the other cultural aspects that differentiate us completely disappear. And we are essentially the same when you come to a certain depth of meditation. So this is the purpose here, and this is why these are very refined defilements, because at this stage you are starting to, you know, to almost like chipping away at your very sense of who you are as a person. And it's a beautiful thing, actually. It's a wonderful thing to get rid of that. The sense of identity is something very coarse and something which actually causes pain and suffering in the world. Get rid of that, or slowly move away from that. It actually is a very beautiful thing. And you get to this beautiful, pure, beautiful state of mind. So, let's see what he says next here. So the earnest, capable person, he abandons, dispels, and terminates and obliterates even these things. Again, remember, it's all about using wisdom, or much more about using wisdom than willpower. Huh? The more deeply you go, the more that is the case. When this has been done, there remains thoughts connected with the Dhamma. I like to translate this as thoughts that accord with the Dhamma. In other words, you have removed all the defilements, and all that you have left are the kind of beautiful thoughts of compassion and loving kindness and these things. So these are thoughts that accord with the Dhamma. They are appropriate thoughts. But the point here is that even they have to be abandoned if you want to make the mind perfectly still. And this is what happens next year. So that's why he says here, that concentration is not yet peaceful and sublime, is not gained, is not fully tranquilized, is not fully unified, but it is still reined in and checked by actively. I don't like the word suppression. It's not really how it works. But it's actively held at bay, perhaps, or something like that. Suppression has this idea of using too much force again. And forcefully, again, it's more like, as I said, actively, there's an activity of the mind still happening, which keeps this in check. But then the Buddha says, but monks, there comes a time when his mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and concentrated, and stilled. That stillness is peaceful and sublime, gained to full tranquility, fully unified, and it is not reined in and checked by actively controlling the defilements. Then, there being a suitable basis, he is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which he might incline his mind. So, if you keep doing this, it says here, there comes a time. This idea that there comes a time means that it is not up to you to decide when your mind is fully purified. It is not up to you to decide when you will have this samadhi experience. You can't really control it. You put in the causes for these things to happen. You put in the conditions, and the results happen by themselves in due course. This is one of those very important principles of Buddhist practice and Buddhist meditation, that you don't make these things happen by looking at the result. All you do, you work on the causes. You work on the foundation principles, and then from that, the causes will happen. You don't know when it's going to be, but one day it happens, right? Gradually, you become more purified, and then there comes a time, and then you achieve this tremendous bliss and happiness that comes from the samadhi experience. But of course, the point is also that as you practice on this path, as you work with this, there's a lot of happiness on the way, even though the full degree of happiness only comes when the mind is perfectly stilled. So, the mind becomes, it says, internally steady, composed, unified, and stilled. And this is a reference to the jhana states, these very deep states of samadhi that are attainable on this path. And that is when the mind is here fully tranquilized. So fully tranquilized, the Buddha doesn't usually mince his words. So fully tranquilized means fully tranquilized. It doesn't mean kind of, you know, a little bit tranquilized. So full tranquility, you can just imagine what that means. It means absolute peace of mind. And it attained to unification. Again, when the Buddha said attained to unification, it means real unification. This is the way the Buddha speaks. See, he doesn't kind of exaggerate his words. He's very precise. When he says unification, it means that. The mind is absolutely 100% unified at this point. And it is no longer reined in and checked by active suppression. This what this means, and this is very interesting as well, it means that when the samadhi, when the meditation becomes very deep, it is 100% natural. There is no usage of the will anymore. There's nothing really happening in the mind. The will has been completely abandoned and left behind. That's what that means. So it is a state of mind that we're not used to. It's a state of mind that you can't really know from your ordinary life when the will is completely 100% abandoned. This is one of the few places in the suttas where it's quite clear that deep samadhi means the complete letting go of the will, The mind is fully, absolutely unified on its object. There's no movement anymore. It's completely still. And that is what this is pointing towards. So that's what happens when you purify your mind. You get to this kind of state of profound samadhi, profound jhana, profound experiences. So the purpose of this sutta is just to give you this idea of the gradual practice, to make sure that you know where you are on the path. Remember to know yourself, and when you know yourself, you can choose the kind of remedy that you need. What is it I need to do to be able to practice properly? What is it I need to do to move forward? Know yourself, then you can apply the right method for you, and then you can start to make progress on the path.